Ladies and gentlemen, this, speaking about human origins and human destiny, religions are of course unanimous in agreement about these two points, human origins and about human destiny. But in this lower world, as you know, appearances are deceptive. And the word religion means a restoring of the ligament. The lig in religion is the ligament which joined man to God, and which joined human intelligence to the world of the hereafter. And the prefix re, of course, means restoring something which has been broken, rebinding the human intelligence, the human soul, to a knowledge of the divine, which he had lost at the fall of man. But here below, I repeat, appearances are deceptive, and once a person has ceased to practice any religion, it does not take long for the appearances to triumph. What seems to be the most real of all things is the material world. The soul also must be real because we are conscious of it. But all beyond that becomes questionable and even improbable. And that is the state of affairs which seems to prevail by a large majority of people in the modern Western world. But man was created with the certitude, this is according to all religions, that the invisible beyond is supreme reality. And all religions are in agreement as regards human origins, that man was created by God in his image. The word creation is often replaced by the word manifestation to make clear that the world is God manifesting himself at a lower level. In fact, in most religions, not only Hinduism, which is the oldest living religion, but the other esotericisms of Christianity and Islam, for example, and Taoism, they tend to prefer the word manifest because that expresses the truth that it is God. Things come into existence through God manifesting himself. There is a beautiful saying which is attributed to the Prophet of Islam. It is almost certainly from him. That's what the Sufis say. It is not officially counted as a saying of his, but as an expression of wisdom. And this is God speaking in the first person. I was a hidden treasure, and I loved to be known, and so I created the world. Now the world consists of macrocosm and microcosm, that is the greater outer, the outer world, the macrocosm, the large world, and the microcosm, the world of man. And man is said in all religions to have been made in the image of God. Now, how are we to define the hidden treasure which is mentioned? That is the supreme reality which some most religions use a word like the divine, a phrase like the divine essence. Religion is a problem because is problematic because when a certain decay of intelligence has taken place and has developed, you cannot really speak of two, as it were, of two levels in the divinity. That would mean, for most people, two gods. But in all esotericism, there is unanimous agreement that one has to distinguish between the divine essence and the personal God, which is divine but acts slightly, it's not at the supreme level of reality. The divine essence is the supreme reality. And how can we define that hidden treasure, referring back again to the saying, I was a hidden treasure and I loved to be known, and so I created the world. How can we define that hidden treasure? One could say, one could use the words absolute, infinite, eternal, incomparable beauty, reality, knowledge, happiness, goodness, unity. One would have to use these words. That is what the supreme reality is, the hidden treasure itself. What then of evil? The writer Fritjof Schoen has given, it seems to me, one of the most remarkable, or the best that I know, explanation of the existence of evil, which is, as you know, a problem for a great many people in the modern world. How can I believe in a God who allows such evil to exist? One has heard that said again and again and again by people who want to make an excuse for no longer having a religion. But it is in the nature of goodness to radiate. And God is undoubtedly not only absolute infinite goodness, but he's also all-powerful. But this power is not at the level of his goodness. In other words, the Almighty cannot and would not wish to prevent his goodness from radiating. And radiation produces distance. And distance is dangerous. Distance from God is dangerous. We have in the beginning of the Christian of the book of Genesis, the Spirit of God breathed upon the face of the waters, and the waters were divided. Now, Hinduism also has that same doctrine of the upper waters and the lower waters. Islam also, just the same, the Quran mentions the two seas, one sweet and fresh, the other salt and bitter. Now, there is no evil in heaven, that is, in the upper waters, since that is within the order of the divine essence itself. The upper waters are where the paradises exist, the hierarchy of the paradises, one above the other. But the knowledge of good and evil is misleading. All good comes from the radiation of the goodness of God. Evil is the result of distance, and only becomes possible on this side, this lower side of what the Quran calls the isthmus between the two seas. All other religions have a similar division. It is the impassable barrier which separates heaven and earth. Impassable, that is, without the divine authority. Now, I remember, since this was mentioned in already, that I was a pupil of C.S. Lewis, I remember attending C.S. Lewis's lectures on, he gave one lecture on the English life and thought in the Middle Ages. It was more or less for the whole of the English, people were studying English throughout the university. It was a general lecture outside his college, because I was at Magdalen, and C.S. Lewis was the English tutor at Magdalen College, but he gave lectures for the whole university at the same time. And in this lecture, I remember being very struck by what he said in connection with education in the Middle Ages, in the Western world, in the Christian world. Students were taught that man has four faculties. First of all, intellect, which is concerned with the realities of the next world. Next, the faculty of reason, which is concerned with this world and which is under the guidance of the intellect. Then, imagination, which is under the same guidance, And finally, sense, that is, the five senses, which are the meeting place of soul and body. Now, it is the intellect which Meister Eckhart defined as being uncreated and uncreatable. That is the divine essence itself. Modern man has, as you know, retained the word intellect on account of its high-sounding nature, but he's lost sight of its meaning. And in the modern world, if we hear someone described as one of the leading intellectuals of our day, it is probable that the person in question will be, in fact, anti-intellectual. That is, not believing that the next world exists. But to come back to true meanings, what is known by the esoterists of all religions, that is the mystics, if you like, I use esoterist as an equivalent of mystic. What is known as the heart, if they are not simply referring to the bodily heart, is the center of the soul. Now, a center is higher than the rest of its domain because it is like a door which opens onto a higher world. And in this sense, we can say that the heart is between the two seas, what we spoke of. That is the upper waters and the lower waters. And it is in this way that the heart is sometimes said to be the throne of the intellect, because, as I said, the intellect, according to medieval teaching, was concerned with the things of the next world. So is the heart, in virtue of being the throne of the intellect. There is a very beautiful Sufi poem by a saint known as called Al-Hallaj. You probably, many of you, heard of Al-Hallaj because he is a very well known Sufi saint. And this poem begins, "I saw my Lord with the eye of the heart. I said, who art thou? He answered, thou." That is expressing the truth, of course, that we are, that our true self, the true self of every man, lies in God himself. That he is our real self. As to other words about which one might ask the meaning of, the word intuition can be used of what lies between the mind, which is the faculty where the faculty of reason works, and the heart. In other words, intuition belongs to the higher reaches of the human intelligence, between the mind and the heart. And what is known as the fall of man is precisely the loss of access to the heart. Now, with regard to the question of human destiny, again, there is unanimity of religions that we must return to our origins. What is named purgatory in Christianity is to be found in all religions. And all esotericism, that is the purpose of its existence, aims at passing through purgatory in this life. According to religious teaching, everybody will have to go through a process of purification. In the vast majority of cases, this takes place after death. Salvation, again, a term which is a truth which is common to all religions, expresses the fact that one is saved from going to hell. But it does not mean, as Henry VIII liked to believe, that one goes thereby straight to heaven. First of all, there must be a purification. That was the doctrine of the Church, and it's the doctrine of every other religion. There must be a purification before one can enter paradise. But esotericism, I repeat, the purpose, one of its purposes of its existence is that it aims at passing through purgatory in this life. In Dante's poem, hell and purgatory are taken separately, but in most religious traditions it is considered that there is a certain simultaneity between the descent into hell, which means the discovery of faults that one was not aware of, and that is the beginning. That discovery is, after all, the beginning of purification. But Dante's two first books, the Inferno and the Purgatorio, which are separate, which separates hell from purgatory, are what are called under the one name of the lesser mysteries, Mysteria Parva. The greater mysteries are the ascent through the paradises of the next world. But what is one to say when one hears the expression of the truth that some children, this is a question, a query about the divine justice, because the justice of God, that God is just, is a certitude, stated as a certitude by every religion that we know of. How are we to explain then the fact that in the modern world, in some parts of the modern world, especially in the big towns, children are sometimes born to pearls, both of whom are criminals, disbelievers, bent on getting what they can, when they can, how they can. And a child is brought up without any knowledge of religion and brought up to have the same attitude as his parents. What chance has such a person, such a child born in those circumstances, what chance has it of being saved? And how can we reconcile this common occurrence in the modern world with the justice of God? Now, if you turn to the older religions, like Hinduism, or, well, that is enough, but Buddhism has the same doctrine, their answer would be that there is absolutely no problem in this question. It must have been that in the baby that is born to these criminal parents, in a previous existence, must have neglected wonderful spiritual possibilities which were offered him, on which he was brought up, and he is on his way out of the human state. There is still, just as a human being, despite his parents, there's still just always the possibility that he might come back to religion, but it's unlikely. And his neglect of those possibilities in his previous existence have started him on a way out of the central state. You see, man is the center of the earthly state. Man is God's representative on earth. All other creatures are peripheral. But man alone is central, and man has the possession, unlike animals, he has free will, he has total intelligence, and he has, or should have, a compassionate soul, that is, one who follows the teachings of Christ, who loves his neighbor as himself, who enters into, who is not egoistic. One must have those three qualities to be the representative of God on earth. An intelligence which conceives the divine reality, which goes far beyond the human world and human nature. An intelligence which understands, is capable of understanding the supreme truth. A will which is free. That is, a will which is not governed, as it is with animals, by instinct. A will which can say to the soul, you cannot have that thing you want. It is not good for you. That is what free will is. And a soul which enters in, which is compassionate, which enters into the other people's lives, is not only limited to his own, not only egoistic, but is compassionate. It enters into other people's lives That is what man should be. And if we, now we do need the doctrine of the samsara, which means that the existence of innumerable worlds, which are on the sort of like a great circle, and in this, in the three monotheistic religions, there is only mention of this one world. Christ said, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. But we do need now this doctrine of more than one world. And now people have knowledge of the older religions, in order to justify the case I mentioned, the possibility of this child being born into the modern world to criminal parents, taught to get what it can, when it can, how it can. I've been told that in some towns there are boys of seven. One finds sometimes boys of seven with faces of men of 40. A horrible thought. But that does exist. But if we believe that there was a previous existence, that same person had a previous existence, which is what all the older religions teach, the answer is, but that is the result of neglecting wonderful possibilities, spiritual possibilities, in one's previous life. Now, to go back to the question of purification, of purgatory, hell and purgatory. It is a doctrine to be found in all the religions, that salvation, that is to be saved from hell, does not mean that one goes straight to paradise. There has to be a maturity, a spiritual maturity has to be reached first, because in all religions there are descriptions of paradise, and one of the most striking aspects of paradise, of the joys of paradise, is precisely the blessed spirits who are there in paradise. The company of these blessed spirits is one of the great, or possibly the greatest, of the joys of paradise, as they are traditionally described. And therefore, I think it was Saint Irenaeus near the beginnings of Christianity, pronounced it to be a heresy to say that salvation means entry into paradise. And all the other religions have the same doctrine expressed in different ways. There has to be a maturity reached, and I have when I was introduced to this evening, something was said about my books, and I actually wrote, I have a book of poems among the books, and wrote a poem on this question of people no longer praying for the dead, why it is necessary to pray for the dead, as in all religions they do. But I was brought up myself to believe that either one is saved or damned. I was brought up as an Anglican, a rather low church Anglican, and either one goes straight to paradise or one goes to hell. And there's no point in praying for the dead, which is nonsense. I wrote a poem on this very, very point, which is in my book of poems. It's called Requiem. It's simply because verse is sometimes more effective than prose as an argument. But one has to understand that these prayers are necessary, and also we may ask the question, what happens to those who, like this boy of 7 with the face of a man of 40, who are on their way out of the human state? They are bound to, they will become peripheral, that is, no longer the representatives of God on earth, but they will belong to some animal, something equivalent. The worlds are all different. We only have, our imagination is made for this world, but the worlds, the divine possibilities are infinite, and the worlds on the circumference of this great circle of different worlds, which the Hindus call the samsara, all the worlds are different. We can only imagine this world, but in each world there is a central species corresponding to man, and the rest of the inhabitants are peripheral. And what happens to somebody who loses the human state, who loses the central state and becomes a peripheral being, an animal or a vegetable even? But we have to remember in this context that there is in the created world a hidden mercy in the dangers of nature. For example, when a lesser animal is killed by a tiger or a lion, who rank very high in the hierarchy of animals, the prey of that animal, which a tiger or a lion devours, the lesser animal will be absorbed into a higher degree of animal life, and at its next stage of existence will have risen in the hierarchy of animals. Now, it's said in Islam, and there must be the equivalent in other religions too, that one of the greatest blessings for an animal is to be ritually sacrificed. And it is said, it is generally believed, that such animals in their next state of existence would have a central state. What I'm trying to say is this, that in nature, the world of nature, there is a merciful tendency for elevation to take place. And a person who has lost the central state on his way out of the central state would have the possibility of returning once again by this merciful ascending tendency which exists in the peripheral world, and there is the possibility of returning. In any case, we have to remember the saying of Christ to Saint Juliana of Norwich, to whom he appeared when she was very troubled by the things like hell, suffering in hell, and she was in a state of trouble over these questions. And as we know, it was in the 12th century, I think, she was an English saint of knowledge. Christ appeared to her, and he said to her, "But, Juliana, all shall be well." And she didn't seem satisfied with that. So he added, "All manner of things shall be well." And we must take this as an answer to any troubles we may have in thinking about these questions, because in fact God manifested everybody in the world, and he is responsible for our existence, and traditionally, our destiny is to return to our origins. Now, to speak just once again of this question, why it is not possible for those who are saved to go straight to paradise. The answer is very clear in the different religions. A soul has to be ready. A soul can be saved and having no longer need to be purified of faults. But at the same time, that does not necessarily mean that the soul in question is capable of being a source of delight to all the other blessed spirits in paradise. And therefore, in every religion, you find there is a question of a waiting place at the edge of paradise, where the soul has to mature. I think it is in Buddhism, there is the image of a lotus bud. The soul one who is saved is placed in a lotus bud at the edge of paradise. And as his maturity or her maturity is perfected, the petals of the lotus open until when the full maturity is reached, the soul in question or the spirit in question is able to enter paradise and be a source of delight to all the other spirits in paradise. But again, one finds in the religions the doctrine of two paradises, that is, that there is the, it is made very, very explicit in the Quran that each soul has two paradises. In one, there is the joy of relationship with other blessed spirits, but in the other, there is question of the relationship of the one spirit with God himself. That is the higher of the two paradises. And the Quran in Islam promises for every soul two paradises. One is concerned with, as I say, with the relationship with other blessed spirits. The other is concerned with one's relationship with God. But in the end, everything returns to God, from, that is, to the divine essence from which it came and which it is bound to return, to which it is bound to return. That is, this, to repeat what I've already said, the absolute, infinite, eternal beauty, reality, knowledge, happiness, goodness, and oneness, which is our origin, and it must be our ultimate source, our ultimate state. The state of return, we must return back to that which was our source. That is what all religions teach. Now, I think I've said enough now to answer perhaps one or two questions if anyone might have, but I think I've spoken long enough about this question.